Good evening. Welcome to The Bookshelf and the final episode of the three parts we've had of Pivot Secrets, Pivot, the storytelling program in Spokane, which took place on May 11th. Previously, over the last two nights, we heard from Linda Ribbon, Ben Faulkner, Mark Robbins, Christopher Horse Thief, and Eugene Jablonski. Tonight, it is Liz Rognes and Isaac Grambo. As always, these stories may contain some adult content, and listener discretion is advised.
Our next storyteller coming up here is going to be Liz Rognes. Liz, where are you?
Late in the summer of 2010, I went for a walk on the farm where I grew up with my dad. It was late in the day and the sun was setting. This was in Iowa and the corn was reaching toward the sky. "Dad," I said, "I have something to tell you." 10 years earlier, I came out to my parents in a therapy session. At the time, there was a lot going on for me. Like a lot of queer kids, I was struggling with depression and anxiety. I was struggling with drug and alcohol abuse and an eating disorder. I had been suicidal. Coming out to my parents was a step toward recovery for me, a step toward feeling more comfortable with who I was. But my parents were surprised. I think that their image of a queer woman was like a stereotypical butch lesbian who drove a motorcycle. And that wasn't me. I had long hair. I sang show tunes in the shower. I was a cheerleader. But when they met my first girlfriend, a swaggery, tough, butch lesbian who played professional football, they adored her. In fact, they came to think of her as like an additional daughter. And when we decided that we were going to move in together, my dad started researching lesbian-friendly neighborhoods in St. Paul, where we lived, because he wanted us to feel comfortable. He wanted us to know that he supported us. We moved in together, and I started to do better. I got sober, and my anxiety lessened. I remember one day, just like a typical evening after dinner, she and I were in the kitchen cleaning up, and I remember just stopping and looking at her and saying, "I feel happy." It was the first time in my adult life that I remember feeling just content. I was healthy, and I was loved, and it felt great. We were young, though, and as time went on, differences in our personalities became sharper. She started hanging out with this other woman from her football team, and eventually she broke up with me. I was heartbroken. My parents climbed into their farm truck and drove from Iowa to St. Paul to help me pack up. As we were packing the last bag, or the last box, my dad, who adored this now ex-girlfriend of mine, looked around the apartment. Sadly, he said, "Gosh, she's just done so much for you. Maybe we should leave her a thank you card." I was like, "No, Dad, that's not what you do." In order to maintain my sobriety, I started going to this AA group that was specifically for lesbian-identified women. Most of the women in that group were a generation or two older than me. I started dating one of them, which is like a thing you're not supposed to do in AA. But I did. Started dating her. She would say this funny thing to me sometimes at random times, like in the grocery store, or like after sex. She would look at me and she would say, "Gosh, I'm so glad you're a lesbian." And the implication was that, yeah, I know, it's weird, right? But but the implication was because otherwise this would be awkward. But also, the implication was, "I'm so glad you're a lesbian as opposed to one of those flaky bisexual femmes. Thank God I wasn't one of those." She worked at the university. I worked part-time at a preschool where I taught music. Meanwhile, at the preschool, we hired another preschool teacher. He was young. He was my age. He was a musician like me. He was a writer like me. We became quick friends, And in fact, we became so close that when my girlfriend and I broke up, I moved in with him just until I could find another place to live. So he lived in this like one bedroom, one bed apartment in St. Paul, close to the preschool where we both worked. And he would joke to me as we sat on the couch watching a movie in the evening, and he'd sling his arm around me, and he would say, "What a relief to be so close to my friend who's a lesbian. There's no sexual tension." And I would snuggle in. "What a relief," I would say. But the thing was, there was sexual tension, and I was confused by this. What did this mean about me? If you're bisexual, people joke that you have like twice as many options for dating, but the truth is that there's powerful stigma surrounding bisexuality and queer fluid identity, especially women's sexuality. If you're bisexual, people might say that you're easy, promiscuous, slutty, indecisive, untrustworthy, wild, crazy, selfish, excessive, insatiable, the list goes on. What if that was me? What did that mean about who I was? At work, our boss, when she found out that we were living together, one day we were sitting at one of those little tables with, because it's a preschool, so we're helping the kids like trace their alphabet, and me and my friend and our boss are sitting there with the children, helping the children do their alphabets, and my boss says to him, "Gosh, living with a lesbian, that's funny. That must be like having money in the bank you can't take out." I know, right? And I felt so ashamed of what was happening for me because I was like falling for him and I didn't know how to talk about what that meant for me. He seemed to be simultaneously attracted to me but also a little bit afraid of my sexuality. One day he said to me, "Liz, if you really want to start dating men, you're going to have to shave your legs." So I was like, okay, so what does this mean about who I am? I don't feel like I can totally conform to all of these heterosexual rights, but also I felt like I was betraying my community of lesbians. I could imagine those women from the meeting saying when they found out that I was dating a man, "We always knew it. She was too femme from the beginning. She always liked straight people things, like aromatherapy and throw pillows." In all seriousness, though, I do understand the suspicion of bisexuality. Some of those women in the meeting had lived through times of even more explicit, violent homophobia. Some of those women from the meeting had lived through the Stonewall era. For some of those women, the line between who is straight and who is gay was important. It could be the marker. It could be a line that told you where you could find safe space or where you might risk encountering violence, hatred, homophobia, even death. Things didn't work out between me and the shave your legs guy. I moved to Spokane. And in Spokane, I dated people of various genders and began to become more comfortable with this orientation that wasn't something I could just check a box to define. But then I met someone who I really liked. And we ended up having a sustained relationship. I realized I was gonna have to tell my parents I had a boyfriend. So, in the late summer of 2010, I went back to the farm, went on a walk with my dad. The sun was setting onto the open prairie horizon. "Dad, I have something to tell you." I was so nervous about how he would react. My biggest fear was that he would be relieved, like, "Oh, thank God, we always hoped that lesbian thing was a phase." Because it wasn't a phase for me. It wasn't like I was tossing in my rainbow towel to cash in on heteronormative privilege. Although in this society, that is how it's kind of read. "I'm dating someone," I said, "and he's a man." And my dad started to laugh, and he was like, "Oh, is that it? I thought you were gonna tell me you were sick." And then I realized that past conversations that had started with, "Dad, I have to tell you something," ended with, "I'm an alcoholic, I'm bulimic, I'm going into the hospital, there's something wrong with my heart, I've been arrested, I'm in jail, I'm in the ICU." This was not a conversation to fear. "Honey," he said, "all I've ever wanted is for you to be healthy and happy. I don't care who you love." So we continued walking in the setting sun. My dad said, "We should head back inside. Your mom has a friend here. She's got some like aromatherapy thing. She wants us to test it out. It's like a little bit lavender, a little bit everything else. Thank you."
Thank you, Liz. I'm going to keep with this theme. Thank you for allowing us into your living room. Our last storyteller here is Isaac Grambo. If you come up and join me.
This is a 100% true story about a man named Carol Dick, with whom I spent 1 month on a 50-foot boat traveling south along the Inside Passage in 1994. In 1994, I was 14 years old, and Carol Dick was at least 80, which means he may as well have been at least a billion. He was old, he was small, he had wispy white hair, he was very cheeky. I don't want to call him jowly. They were much more spherical than jowls. They were cheeks. And he had squinty eyes. And he looked like Mr. Magoo, wearing a 1990s grandpa baseball hat. If you know the 1990s, you know what grandpa baseball hats looked like in the 1990s. Carol Dick was my grandfather's best friend from childhood. They had known each other for a very, very, very long time. And this trip along the Inside Passage was sort of their bucket list. My grandpa owned the boat, and they traveled up all the way to Prince Rupert, British Columbia. And that was where we joined them and traveled down. If you're not familiar with the Inside Passage is a waterway that goes along the coast of British Columbia. It is shielded from the Pacific Ocean by a series of islands. One of those islands is Vancouver Island. It's the biggest one. There's a whole bunch of other islands north of that. And that shields it from the ocean, so it is placid. It is calm. It is beautiful. So, we had one set of family members accompany my grandfather and Carol Dick all the way north up to Prince Rupert. Then my immediate family joined them, the other family members left, and so it was myself, my brother Adam, my brother Lincoln, my father, my grandpa, and Carol Dick traveling south along the Inside Passage. The Inside Passage is a fantastic place. You have really just like bright royal blue water, trees that are cedar trees and fir trees that come all the way down to the waterline, and then the bright blue sky over that. There probably was a cloudy day on this trip, but I do not remember one. I remember it being sunny the entire time. And this is the kind of place where wildlife is everywhere. We had food that we packed with us, but we didn't need to pack a lot in the way of meat because we sort of ate our way south along the coast of British Columbia. We fished for rock bass. We fished for sea bass. We fished for salmon. We fished for halibut. We saw whales. We saw bald eagles everywhere. It was the kind of place where you could be sitting on the back of the boat and watch a bald eagle overhead, flying along, and then dive down, pick up a giant salmon, and fly off to the next tree. which was really cool. It was not so cool if you were in the process of fishing when that happened, and you were reeling in said salmon that the bald eagle stole from you and took away. Now, this was a beautiful trip, and it was an amazing trip. But as you are on the water that long, eating basically fish and the orange here or there to stave off scurvy, your brain kind of starts to mess with you. We were at one harbor where we had spent the night, and we were fishing off of the bow for dinner or breakfast or something. And we were fishing for bass, and so we were casting out and reeling in, and casting out and reeling in. And my younger brother, who was 11 at the time, is reeling in, and he casts out, and he lets go of the fishing rod. And out it goes into the bay. Other things about this trip, this is 1994. It is before the internet. It is before GPS. We are navigating by charts that we have in books, guidebooks, and a Loran radar system, which if you don't know what that is, just know that it's cool. So we would stop at different places that were shown in the guidebooks. We went to really cool ghost towns. We went to sort of tourist communities. We stopped at one place called Klemtu. Klemtu was a pretty cool place, and this is where I started to realize that while I thought Carol Dick was ancient, now, after about 2 weeks on this trip, he was starting to get on my nerves. Because Carol Dick did not move very quickly for anything. And so we are at this town called Klemtu. We are getting gas. Carol Dick is kind of wandering around, puttering around, and he's taking his sweet time, and I have had enough of that. So I go out into town to look around, and by the time I'm done, I'm sure Carol will be back on the boat, and we can leave. So I go out, and I meet some people in this remote village of Klemtu. Between the four people I talked to, there were possibly 6 to 8 teeth. And we had long conversation. It was 1994. The World Cup was happening in the United States. We talked about soccer. We're in Canada, so we talked about the U.S. team. We talked about the Canadian team. Had a lot of conversation about soccer. Finally, I got myself away from the conversation about soccer, went back, and my mom, who I forgot to mention, also on this trip, my mom says, "What the hell are you doing? Get on the boat, get on the boat, get on the boat, get on the boat." On the boat. What the hell? Apparently, according to the guidebook, Klemtu is a place that in the guidebook it says, if you must stop at Klemtu, which if it starts with, if you must stop there, you know it's not the greatest story for the rest of it. If you must stop at Klemtu, stay at the fueling dock. Do not go into the village. They are not friendly to outsiders. Lies. We continue this trip. And as we continue this trip, every port we stop at, every time we stop at a tourist town, we go into town, and it takes Carol Dick a little bit longer and a little bit longer to get back to the boat. At our last stop, before we're going to get onto the Strait of Juan de Fuca and head out to the Pacific Ocean and then down the coast of Washington to the mouth of the Columbia and back to our home of Longview, Washington, we are stopped. We are fishing for salmon the one last time. And the whole time we're fishing, I catch my limit, my little brother catches his limit, my other brother catches his limit, Carol hasn't caught anything. Finally, Lincoln catches his, my younger brother, and my dad makes Lincoln give his rod to Carol Dick. He says it's so he doesn't throw it in the ocean the way he had done with the earlier fishing rod. And Carol Dick starts reeling in this fish. And he reels it in, and the fish runs. He reels it in, fish takes another run. It took 45 minutes, an hour, I don't know, I was 14. It took 9 years for him to finally reel this fish in, taking his sweet Carol Dick time all the way in. Get the fish in. As we start to make our run down the coast of Washington, I am at the helm because my grandfather has told me at 14 that I am the best helmsman he has ever had. Yeah, that's right. Me, 14-year-old Isaac, best helmsman on the boat. We are running down the coast of Washington. We are 12 miles offshore. This was the only cloudy day I remember on this trip. We are 12 miles offshore, which means we probably couldn't have seen the shore anyway, but we had probably 10 miles of visibility, which meant I certainly couldn't see the shore. Which means when you're driving in the ocean with no landmarks and you can't see anything, you're going only by your instruments. So I am looking at that compass, and I'm keeping it at due south, 180 degrees. Okay, we're going. And I know my way around the steering wheel of this ship. And I know how to compensate for the waves as they go up and down, side to side. I know how to do this. My dad comes up to the bridge and he says, Isaac, you got to move off. You got to give Carol Dick a chance to steer the ship. And I do not want to do this. Because Carol Dick is a slow man. He doesn't have the reaction time of a 14-year-old. And it feels like we're going to go out to China if I leave the helm. So I sprint down below decks. I make myself a peanut butter sandwich. I eat it as fast as I can. I come back up to the helm, grab that steering wheel, and my dad comes up and he says, okay, we're 4 miles off course. We're going to have to make an adjustment, and we're going to go back in. Damn it, Carol Dick. We make the run all the way down the coast of Washington State. We go up the Columbia River. We dock, finally at home in Longview, Washington. And myself and my two brothers start unloading this boat. And we are very excited to be on dry land. We are very excited to be on dry land now for some time. So we're packing things back and forth, going down to the dock, getting something, packing it up to the cars, down to the dock, get something, pack it up to the cars. This whole time, Carol Dick, unladen, is walking up the dock. And we're going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And he's just kind of going up the ramp. I am not exaggerating when I tell you that it took Carol Dick an hour and a half to get from the boat to his car. A distance of possibly 50 meters. Our trip is over, and we go home. And my father, and my siblings, and my mother and I are at home, and we are eating terrestrial dinner for the first time in a month. It is meatloaf. It does not smell like salt. It is delicious. And we're sitting down for dinner, and the phone rings. And it's my grandfather who tells us that Carol Dick was just taken to the hospital. And I don't remember really. It's been a number of years since then. I do not remember clearly if Carol Dick died that night or if he died later on. In my memory, he died that night. And I look back on that trip, on this bucket list trip for Carol Dick and my grandfather, and how annoyed I was at 14 years old at this tiny Mr. Magoo wispy old man going so slowly everywhere, and how angry I was at my dad for letting him take so long to reel in that fish, for letting him steer us 4 miles off course in the ocean when we couldn't see the land. Now, I think my dad had an idea that this was Carol Dick's last trip. And I'm pretty sure my grandpa knew that this was Carol Dick's last trip. And I know that Carol Dick knew that this was Carol Dick's last trip. And when I think about this story, I wonder if when my time comes, well, I know.
Thank you, Isaac.
This was the final in the series, that took place on May 11th of Pivot, and specifically Pivot Secrets. Tonight we heard from Liz Rugness and Isaac Grambo. The previous two episodes we'd heard from Linda Ripien, Ben Faulkner, Mark Robbins, Christopher Horse Thief, and Eugene Jablonski. The hosts for this storytelling program were Morgan Marum and Eric Woodard. Pivot organizers include Joe Albert, Josh Armstrong, Luke Baumgarten, Rich Eichsted, Deborah Gore, Melissa Huggins, Jennifer Knickerbocker, Morgan Marum, Brooke Mattson, and Eric Woodard. Pivot, a recent initiative in Spokane, operates on two levels. Tonight and previously, when we had broadcast the stories from the February session, these were vetted stories with specifically chosen storytellers who then had been rehearsed and worked with for a smooth presentation. Alternatively, there's a People's Version of Pivot which takes place, and the next one is scheduled for June 3rd at Sparks Central in Kendall Yards under the idea of Close Calls. The public is invited to show up and sign up to do a five-minute storytelling on that theme of close calls. It's easy to find out about Pivot Spokane. Simply Google it and you will be there, or go to pivotspokane.com and they will be announcing their upcoming events there. At Spokane Public Radio, it's our pleasure to bring these to the airwaves, and especially deep thanks to these seven storytellers who dared tell deep and personal stories. I find it very embracing for us all to be able to realize the truth of our own humanity, share it with each other, and we've been given a great gift from these seven storytellers that we enjoyed tonight. Monday on the bookshelf, we return to the long-form reading of an entire book, the extraordinary novel The Art of Racing in the Rain by Garth Stein, as read by Susan Williams. An amazing book. Don't miss it. Get that habit going of Monday through Thursday, 6:30 until 7. Thanks. I'm Vern Windham.